I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of May. An article in the New York Times on April 29 caught our attention. Two giant banks seen as immune become targets. Federal prosecutors, the article goes, are nearing criminal charges against some of the world's biggest banks. It could produce the first guilty plea from a major bank in more than two decades. The author of the article will be joining us for the first part of our program. The second part of the program, what are we doing to make sure that the huge institutions on Wall Street can't bring down the economy again? Elizabeth Warren has said recently, 3 years since Dodd-Frank was passed, the biggest banks are bigger than ever, and the risks to the system have grown. The market distortions continue. And our guest for that segment of the show is Marcus Stanley, Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Ben Protas is our guest. The first part of the program today, the author of the piece in the New York Times Deal Book. He worked for the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, where he had been a business reporter based in Washington. And he's also been a reporter at Neighborhood Newspaper in Chicago and for the CBS News affiliate in Chicago. We'll be welcoming phone calls on these very large issues during the course of this hour. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Feel free to leave messages for us any of those places. Ben, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how long has this been in the works, federal prosecutors nearing criminal charges against these two banks?
The last several months, we've been approaching the possibility that, in this case, we're talking about Credit Suisse, the giant Swiss bank, and BNP Paribas, which is the France's largest bank. So really, this has been the culmination of kind of several years of investigating, and then the last few months, really, in kind of focusing in on the possibility of actual criminal guilty pleas.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what their wrongdoing was, starting with Credit Suisse.
Sure. So with Credit Suisse, the suspected wrongdoing is the enabling of Americans to hide wealth overseas. So certainly a lot of people have known about the Swiss banking secrecy, and this is kind of a prime example. Other banks have come under scrutiny for it. Credit Suisse is certainly not not the first, but it's been perhaps one of the worst.
And who? And with, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, within BNP Paribas, you have the possibility that they basically ignored U.S. sanctions violations. So basically, they're enabling and processing transactions for companies in countries like Sudan, Iran, Cuba, and basically in pretty serious violation of American sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of people who hide their wealth overseas?
There are, and you know, certainly kind of what's happened in the last few years is, since UBS, the giant Swiss bank, kind of came under scrutiny for this, there's been progress between the IRS, the Department of Justice, and the Swiss authorities to try to fix this and remedy this as best they can. It's been a very slow process, and very recently there's been some treaties that have been reached that have kind of improved the transparency, but it's been a very slow-going process.
Mm-hmm. And the headline of the New York Times article, Ben, is two giant banks seen as immune become targets. Why were they seen as immune?
Well, as you probably remember during the financial crisis, that one of the big mantras afterward was that, you know, no financial institution was criminally charged and no big bank CEO was criminally charged and related to the crisis. And so I think it became this perception that these financial institutions had become so large and interconnected and important to the economy that no prosecutor was going to be able to charge them for fear that it would have this systemic impact on the economy.
Mm-hmm. And these are foreign-owned companies?
These particular ones are, so we're talking about Credit Suisse and BNP, and again, those are, you know, it's a Swiss bank and a French bank. But the thing to keep in mind is, they're huge institutions in their countries, but they also have huge presence in New York. Certainly BNP and Credit Suisse are big investment banking operations in New York, so they have banking licenses here, and there's no way that they can just kind of skirt or ignore U.S. laws. They have to operate within the confines of them.
Mm-hmm. When you say in the article that prosecutors and regulators are meeting about how to criminally punish banks without putting them them out of business and damaging the economy. How do you do that?
That's a great question. That's kind of at the heart of this whole issue, is if prosecutors and Justice Department really want to prove that banks are not too big to jail, as the saying goes, then they have to kind of figure out a way to charge them or get a guilty plea in these situations. While predicting in advance that there won't be this catastrophic impact. So what they're doing, the prosecutors are doing, is they're meeting with the banking regulators in New York and in Washington to try to figure out in advance, if we get a guilty plea and it's from the parent company, what will be the impact? And so they're basically meeting several times over the last few months to try to make sure that the impact, while significant, isn't the death penalty.
And what do you think about this? Could there be, if the penalty was significant enough, and I guess we'd have to figure out what that would be to be significant enough, could it be catastrophic?
So I think that what they're trying to do in these cases is get guilty pleas. Let's take the case of BNP. The idea is they're going to try to get a guilty plea from the parent company, which is, again, the first time we've seen this in more than two decades, parent company of a big bank of a major bank to plead guilty. So if that happens, certainly there are various repercussions of that. Potentially regulators could suspend different abilities of the bank to clear dollars through the New York operation. There's various things that could be a serious blow to the bank, but the real death penalty would be the pulling of the charter, and this is what the prosecutors have done, is they've worked with the regulators to make sure that, okay, if there is this guilty plea, can you promise that you're not going to pull the charter? And that's essentially what the regulators have agreed to do. They won't pull the charter, even if they do add on with their own fines and suspend different operations. There'll be a significant fallout, but it won't be the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. And Ben, who are the prosecutors? The Justice Department is involved here, and who else?
So you have the Justice Department in Washington, the Criminal Division, but they're working in partnership with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, and then also the District Attorney, the state-level attorney here, Cyrus Vance. And now in Credit Suisse, you have federal prosecutors in Virginia working with the Justice Department in Washington. But the main kind of element running throughout all of this is the Justice Department in Washington kind of coordinating these investigations with different U.S. Attorney's Offices.
And is there some reason there's been so much hoopla, at least in some quarters since 2008, about not taking on big Wall Street banks? Is there some reason, is this a test run, taking on these foreign-owned banks or what?
Yeah, that's the question we've heard a lot since our story ran about a week ago, is we've been really getting a lot of questions about, well, why foreign institutions? Is this just the test run? And the answer is twofold. I think one is, yes, it is partly a test run. And I think that this strategy of getting the guilty pleas but also limiting preventing the charter from being pulled is applicable to American banks as well. And these are just happen to be the first two. The second, I think, kind of prong of it is that it's a bit of a coincidence. The two furthest along investigations happen to be Credit Suisse and BNP, and they happen to be foreign institutions. So it's a little bit of a coincidence that they're both foreign firms. On the other hand, I think it provides prosecutors with a little bit of a test run to see, okay, how does this go, and then how can it be applied to American financial institutions?
Yeah. So this idea that too big to fail, you now say there's a possibility that it might be too big to indict. What
right.
does that mean? Why would it be too big to indict?
So in the case of HSBC, which is this big British bank that was suspected of money laundering and sanctions violations for years and years, they reached what's called the deferred prosecution agreement. This has happened about a year and a half ago. And everyone said, look, they were enabling Mexican drug cartels. They were enabling kind of various money laundering activities. And why shouldn't this bank be indicted or made to plead guilty? Why did they get a deferred prosecution agreement, suspends criminal charges? And the answer was that the regulators essentially threatened behind the scenes that they might have to pull the charter, and that would put the bank out of business. And if HSBC's huge bank is put out of business, then potentially you have this fallout where the economy could suffer some serious damages, both in Britain and in the United States. So the idea is these institutions have grown so big and so interconnected that if they are put out of business, you could really have a run on Wall Street financial institutions as a whole, and there's no way that the government is going to let that happen. And so that's kind of the concern, is how can you control for it? How can you punish banks without, you know, leading to this catastrophic consequence. Mm.
And what records are transparent here? How would you know that they were aiding Mexican drug cartels?
So essentially you have, in the case of prosecutors, they will see, they will follow drug money, you know, known drug entities that are, you know, shipping money into the United States financial system, and they'll basically track that money and see what accounts it flows through. And, you know, if there reaches this critical mass, then, and it's really centering on HSBC or, you know, whatever institution it may be, then there's kind of a pattern that they're able to detect. And basically the prosecutors are able to subpoena records from any major financial institution, any financial institution that has presence in the United States.
Mm-hmm. The banks are also, I would imagine, most all of them required to conduct their own internal investigations?
That's correct. That's correct. And so banks are obligated to file what's called SARS reports, suspicious activity reports, every time that they get a transaction through their institution that seems a little funky. And they're supposed to report it, and sometimes they do, and that's kind of what's essential to the, you know, monitoring of the markets and money laundering and whatnot. But sometimes they don't file the suspicious activities reports, and that what ends up coming back to haunt them. Prosecutors can use that to say, look, you willfully ignored your responsibilities, and you should have protected the financial system from money laundering, but instead you look the other way.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls and emails. We already have several of them. We're looking at a couple of issues here. One is a story that appeared just recently and has some saying that perhaps the prosecution of the big Wall Street banks may be close at hand because of this story. Federal prosecutors are nearing criminal charges against some of the world's biggest banks, and there are two of them, a French bank and a Swiss bank. And we're talking with the author of the article in The Times. Ben Protas is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. A little later in the show, we'll be moving into the four biggest Wall Street banks, and they're larger, 30% larger since before the financial crisis of 2008, holding more than half the bank assets in the country. What about those banks? And should we, if there is a government bailout in the future, would we be bailing them out in the future as we did in the past? We'll take on that issue as well. Let's go to Frank in Onalaska, our first caller for you. Hi, Frank.
Hi, great show. I'm glad you're addressing this because to me it's a question of where Obama's administration can pull themselves back into a progressive vein if they actually take action here. The question for the guest, and he kind of got a little ahead of my question, was with the drug laundering, the mortgage fraud, pulling charters is the big hammer, but why didn't we put anybody in jail here? There's obviously executives and, you know, other staff members that never were charged. And we're talking about, you know, and I'm referring specifically to the drug laundering. You know, you talk about, you know, going after the drug cartel lords, but, you know, here's these bankers that were facilitating, they're doing the business, and we didn't put them in jail. What's the difference here between, you know, the different laws and why we let them off? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. That's something that's kind of plagued the Justice Department, is this kind of two-tiered prosecution where you go after kind of the individual you know, mortgage brokers who facilitated the bad loan, but you don't go after the big bank that kind of really enabled the larger system. In the case of the drug laundering, you know, you go after the dealers and the folks on the street, but you don't go after the banks that really enable it. And I think that this has kind of finally led to this recognition in the last couple of years from the Justice Department. Attorney General Eric Holder has kind of said, look, we have to kind of proceed as if, you know, it doesn't matter how big or how small, if the wrongdoing is there, there has to be the prosecution. And that's something that actually just yesterday he put out a video message on the Justice Department's website saying no bank is too big to jail, no CEO is too big to indict. And I think they're just starting now to kind of really address this head on and in a public way.
Anything else, Frank?
Well, I guess as I was starting off, I think this is really the make or break in terms of what I'd like to see the administration do, because I feel that with the, you know, the stalemate in Congress, that they really need to take action on this level. But I think the, you know, the way that the political campaign financing and, you know, Obama's administration, his treasury officials, all the people that are working in the administration, that it's just not going to happen. The U.S. banks aren't going to be charged. They're not going to be criminalized. And to me, it's going to be a litmus test, though, as to whether we've got a serious president there.
Ben, what's your sense of that?
Well, I think that's a great point, is that, you know, the American institutions, just recently we had J.P. Morgan Chase was, you know, under investigation for basically suspected turning a blind eye to Bernie Madoff's fraud, you know, massive Ponzi scheme. And everyone thought that that was going to be the case, that finally there was going to be a guilty plea or an indictment. You know, almost always it's going to be a guilty plea for an American bank, and ended up that, no, in fact, they got a deferred prosecution agreement. Still a serious, you know, it's a $2 billion fine. It's still a huge deal, but there still wasn't that charge. And so I think the public is appropriately skeptical about whether or not this will end up applying to American banks, not just foreign ones.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thank you, Frank, very much for the call. And it was a long time. They had a long time to look at all of this. Why is all of this breaking right now? Because it's close to an election, or what's going on?
So, at least on the surface, it takes a long time to put these kinds of investigations together. And our understanding is it's been going on for about 3 years.
Mm.
And in certain cases, banks actually, as you mentioned earlier, kind of will do an internal investigation and then turn over the results to the Department of Justice and say, look, we did discover this. So there has to be kind of a vetting of that internal investigation, and that takes time. And then, of course, there's the months-long of negotiating over the exact penalty and the exact punishment. So I think that that's kind of what explains the long. I don't think there's any kind of broader political significance to now, why now for these two banks. I think it really happens to be that there's the culmination of 3 years of investigating.
We'll take more phone calls momentarily. Ben Protas is our guest, a writer for the New York Times Deal Book, and we're talking about a story that he did just last week on April 29, looking at possible prosecution of two foreign banks, Credit Suisse and BNP. That one's out of France. And we'll be looking at a larger issue, too. Will there be American banks that will be charged here in the aftermath of the financial crisis of 2008? And even though it was horrible for Americans, the biggest banks are bigger than ever. And some are saying that the risks to the system have grown. Market distortions continue. What do you think? Are they just too – is everybody so beholden to these firms that the chance of anybody having to go to jail for wrongdoing that cost American taxpayers a whole lot of money is just out of the question? Or do you have faith that this is the beginning of prosecution of American banks? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. And Ben, we thank you very much. We're going to move on to the broader topic of American banks. Thank you so much for writing the article, and it was interesting to read, and we'll follow this with great interest.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Protas will continue. Marcus Stanley will be joining us, Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. That's coming up in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now on the Ideas Network is Marcus Stanley, who is Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform, a coalition of more than 250 national, state, and local groups who have come together to advocate for reform of the financial sector. And he is members include consumer and labor and civil rights, investor, retiree, community, faith-based, and business groups. He has a PhD, Dr. Stanley, in public policy from Harvard, and worked as an economist and policy advisor to Senator Barbara Boxer, as a senior economist at the U.S. Joint Economic Committee, and also as an assistant professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Marcus Stanley, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When you hear about the possible prosecution and deep investigation of these two foreign banks, do you think that is an indication that American banks are next?
We've had many opportunities to go after American banks in the years since the financial crisis, and not just American banks, but specific individuals within those banks who were involved with what frankly looks like fraudulent behavior that led to the global financial crisis or helped lead to the global financial crisis. And we haven't really seen the government do that. I mean, we have seen charges against Standard & Poor's, which is positive. But we've seen really pretty small settlements against a lot of the major banks, in some cases without admitting criminal wrongdoing and without penalties on individuals. So I would have to say that I remain to be convinced as far as American banks go.
So the obvious question is why? Why didn't we see some kind of prosecution? Why?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and that's particularly interesting because we did see a lot of prosecutions in the case of in the S&L crisis, which involved the collapse of many, many community banks in the 1980s, and we also saw very prominent prosecutions in the accounting scandals of the early 2000s, and a lot of the complex financial frauds, essentially, that contributed to the financial crisis were very Enron-esque. But in the case of Enron, people went to jail, and here we really haven't seen it. There's a lot of. I'm not a lawyer, as you said. My background is in economics, and there's a lot of back and forth among lawyers as to why this is so. People talk about statutes of limitation. President Obama claimed that a lot of this behavior that to an outsider looks fraudulent was perhaps not criminal. He said that in a 60 Minutes interview, I believe. But there was a recent article by a federal judge in the New York Review of Books who was also questioning this, and he said that he just felt that there wasn't really the willingness to go after some of this behavior, and part of that was that he felt this was Jed Rakoff, the federal judge that I'm talking about, and part of that was he felt that there had been some sort of, I wouldn't call it cooperation by the federal government with these, by federal regulators with these practices, but almost a little bit of a policy of looking the other way because of the short-term economic benefits that the housing bubble might have brought. And he just felt that this entanglement between the government and the higher levels of the financial industry had led to reluctance to bring charges. And, you know, that's I don't think he wasn't claiming specific personal corruption. He wasn't claiming that bribes were given or anything like that. But I think he was saying that there had been kind of this almost ideological tendency to look the other way for years as these problems were building up. Mm. And then when the collapse came, people were not prepared to see these things as criminal problems or even civil problems, I should add, because I think I'm not personally a big fan of mass incarceration and the number of people we send to prison in this country, but it's striking that the high level executives who personally profited from the sale of what later turned out to be toxic assets that imposed huge losses on investors in the economy collected payments and bonuses for making those sales, and they haven't had to pay any of that back.
Yeah.
The top executives at Lehman took out billions of dollars from that company before its collapse, and they haven't had to return it.
Yeah. Is there something, or is this a stretch, when we hear, and we hear it frequently, one of our Facebook comments from Brad is, Senator Durbin said several years ago, Wall Street owns this place, meaning federal government in Washington, D.C. Is there a connection? It's sort of hard to think that it would be otherwise, between campaign contributions and people who are in the federal government, and a lot of them are coming from Wall Street, or is that too simplistic?
Well, there's a lot of connections. Campaign contributions are only one of them. I mean, Elizabeth Warren gave an interesting speech, I think, I can't remember, I think it was at the end of last week, within the last couple of days anyway, on what she called the Citigroup clique and the number of people in high-level regulatory and political positions who have come from Citigroup. We saw something similar in the Bush administration with Goldman Sachs. There are a lot of these connections that are there, and they can be financial connections in the sense that obviously if someone previously worked for a bank, they were paid by the bank. I think there's also there's a kind of ideological capture that took place where the sort of anything goes assumptions on Wall Street were accepted by regulators. The sort of buyer beware assumptions that if you can that the counterparties, the individuals you're dealing with on Wall Street are sophisticated, and if you can get them to pay money for something that you know is junk and they don't understand as well as you do, if you can essentially fool them in a transaction, then that's okay. That's just kind of how the markets work, and that markets are self-regulating and people can take care of themselves, and that led to kind of an acceptance of fraudulent and criminal behavior. I think that there hasn't been enough of an ideological shift after the crisis around that. I mean, one of the issues we work on is something called fiduciary duty, which is basically the idea that that people in the financial sector should look out for the best interests of their clients when they're giving them advice and selling them a product. I mean, obviously, that wouldn't say that if someone wants to buy something from you that you're, you know, required to do due diligence for them. But if you make representations to them and give them advice, telling them that something is a good idea, then you should be responsible for that advice. It's been very, very difficult to get the regulators to accept that principle and enforce it.
Yeah. Here's an email that comes in from Paul, and I'm glad he asked this. He wants to know, when there are fines, who pays those fines? The customers? He goes on to say, increasingly, oligarchy limits their choices. Given the reach of the bank's interests, this essentially means that the public pays, or a significant fraction thereof. I don't see fines providing any effective resource.
That is a great question, because so many of these cases have been decided by fines at the corporate level. And then the question is, you know, who is really paying that fine, as he says. And I'm not sure it's the customers necessarily, because it depends how much, as he also hints there, it depends how much market power the bank has. I mean, if one bank is being fined and its competitors aren't, then it might be difficult for the bank to pass those costs off. But it could be the stockholders of the bank. It could be employees of the bank who weren't at fault. A large fraction of bank revenues do go to high-level executives, so some of the impact of that fine might hit executives. But you also have cases where, you know, J.P. Morgan has been fined a large amount over the last couple of years in multiple cases, and their CEO recently announced record compensation. So it doesn't always go to the high-level executives. And as I said before, I think it's really a huge problem that people have walked away from failing companies with enormous amounts of money that were earned before those companies failed, or before those companies received government assistance, with bonuses that they received during the bubble period, and they've kept them. I think there was a study out of Harvard that found that the top 10 executives of Bear Stearns and Lehman, whose collapse triggered the financial crisis, walked away with something like $5 billion in total personal compensation over the years prior to that collapse. And, you know, as long as that's happening, you have to wonder, you know, you're just not putting the right incentives out there. I mean, a core principle of economics is that incentives matter. And if you can pass all the rules you want, but if individuals who violate those rules don't have to disgorge their profits, pay fines, take a penalty,
sure,
then, you know, realistically, are those rules going to get followed?
Well, Marcus, who are those people? Don't they have a sense of shame?
Well, you'd have to have them on there on your program.
We'll ask KP to book one of them.
They're a little hard to book, huh?
Yeah, I'll bet they are.
I mean, I'm sure that there are people who feel that everybody was doing it. You know, there was an executive. I'm trying to remember his name. I believe it was Chuck Prince from Citibank who said, well, you know, as long as the music is playing, we've got to dance. In other words, as long as these are the market practices, then if we don't go along, we lose business. And that's why it's very important for the regulators to kind of save the market from itself, you know, that there's kind of, unless regulators are in there really enforcing rules, imposing fines, cutting off the access of firms that are wrongdoers to the market, then you get this downhill slide in ethics and in other things. And frankly, you know, we've passed many pages of financial reforms, and there are some good words in the Dodd-Frank Act, mm-hmm, that if they were really strongly enforced might make a difference, but we haven't really seen the rulemaking and enforcement that it takes to fully change those incentives, I think.
We're talking this part of the program with Marcus Stanley. He's Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform, a coalition of more than 250 national, state, and local groups who have come together to advocate for reform of the financial sector. We're doing a larger look at the big banks with the news just last week that two foreign banks, a Swiss bank and a French bank, may face criminal charges here. And it's a matter of trying to figure out how you punish, in what way you punish these banks for money laundering from drug cartels and being safe havens for Americans who are wealthy, who are trying to hide their money somewhere overseas. How do you punish them without hurting the economic system? But it also begs the larger question, are U.S. banks, particularly those who are responsible for the financial crisis of 2008, next? Should they be? And if so, how? Here's our phone number. Lines are open for you, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marcus Stanley is with us this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. Richard in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Richard.
I had a question. Did the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 in any way contribute to the financial mess of 2008?
I think that it did. it's a complicated set of questions because the Glass-Steagall framework was kind of fraying even before 1999. The regulators were allowing commercial banks to do more and more investment bank-type activities. And I think that, you know, we certainly had financial problems that you could point to before Glass-Steagall. We had the S&L crisis. We had fraudulent behavior or types of fraudulent behavior by Drexel, Burnham, Lambert, and Salomon Brothers. But the thing that you notice in the problems before Glass-Steagall was repealed is that you didn't have the level of sort of crushing economic impact where the problem spread to every area of the financial sector almost instantaneously when they started to happen, and from there out to the real economy as strongly. I mean, the S&L crisis did cause a recession, but it wasn't nearly as bad a recession as what we saw in 2008. And I think what the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the weakening of Glass-Steagall before the crisis, before 1999 did, is it allowed the whole banking system to sort of go all in together on the same set of bets. And those bets had to do not just with making the mortgages, but investing in all these very complex securitizations that were based on the value of mortgages, both investing in those securitizations, selling them, trading them, structuring them, holding them on their trading books. Everybody was exposed. All the financial institutions across the board were exposed to these sets of risks, and they had sort of placed a much more gigantic bet than you could have when those Glass-Steagall walls and divisions were in place. So if we had still had Glass-Steagall and we had had, you know, these problems in securitization markets and problems, you might have had Bear Stearns and Lehman go down. You might have had some of the non-bank lenders go down. But would it have been as crippling to these gigantic commercial banks like Citibank, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan that might have faced more of these Glass-Steagall limitations? I don't think that it would have. So, you know, we used to have firewalls in the economy more. And another thing that I think happened with Glass-Steagall is you got sort of this traders mentality. The profession of banking, of making loans to people, is a little different than the profession of trading.
Sure.
On the financial markets. One is much more short term, one is more long term, and those, they kind of grew together more without those Glass-Steagall divisions.
Thank you very much for the call. I believe it was, I know Senator Warren appeared before your group in November, and I believe she said this. She said a lot of things about the financial crisis, that the crash in 2008 cost, this is phenomenal, I mean, it's a year's worth of salary for Americans, $120,000 for each American household. That's a phenomenal figure. You would think that there would be some kind of groundswell of cries for investigate these people who walked away with billions. You made me lose 3 years of my household income. Wouldn't you?
Well, of course, some of that impact is very concentrated on you know, the people who lost some of those 8 million jobs that were lost after the crisis, and people who ended up underwater on their mortgage. And some of it's invisible to people because or not as visible because it's economic growth that didn't happen. But, you know, I think there was a groundswell. I think there's a ton of anger out there. I mean, when we do polling, it shows up. It actually shows up on a bipartisan basis among both Republicans and Democrats, that people don't feel there's tough enough enforcement on Wall Street, mm-hmm. that they clearly understand that there was criminal behavior. But I think that we have problems in the responsiveness of our political system, frankly. I mean, that article by Judge Rakoff, which is available on the web and very good piece to look at, he sort of goes through the excuses used by the Justice Department not to prosecute people, that, you know, that they couldn't find intent on the part of the banks that were selling these toxic assets, that they couldn't prove that people relied on these banks in making their purchase decisions. And he says that's really, those excuses don't hold water. You know, as a federal judge, I see plenty of cases where you don't have to prove intent, where you have a sophisticated party who should have known that they were doing something irresponsible. It's disturbing that there hasn't been stronger action.
Yeah. Peter,
I don't think it's because there isn't public anger either.
Peter in Stoughton, hi.
Good afternoon. I learned both of these things on the internet, so they must be true. First of all, Iceland successfully prosecuted a few of their bankers shortly after the crisis, and their economy is now performing much better than most in the world. And secondly, I believe that the fines that have been paid are tax deductible, which really blows my mind.
Yeah, I've heard the same things about Iceland that you have, but I'm not really an Iceland expert, so I'm not going to go into that too much. Except one little note is that they are a tiny country that incurred, the debts that their banks incurred just dwarfed the national economy. So they were kind of forced into more radical action because there was just no way that they could bail out the banks. But and the second thing you've heard is true, that many corporate fines, I think, again, I'm not a lawyer, there are a few exceptions on this, but many corporate fines are tax deductible because they can be classified as a business expense, like paying your employees or running your equipment. And that really is not a good principle, to say that fines are a cost of doing business. I think that I think it may vary based on the criminality of the behavior, but I'm not completely sure. But there are a couple of bills in Congress to take that on, to reverse that. But yeah, as long as that's true, that the fines are tax deductible, then the taxpayer is effectively picking up a little bit of that fine.
Mm. And maybe we should do a show on Iceland. That might be interesting, huh? Yeah. Let's go next to Frank in Green Bay. Hi, Frank.
Hi there. I just wanted to know whether I was being too cynical to think that the Attorney General will be happy to prosecute overseas banks, but we'll never see him prosecute a Wall Street bank.
Well, the U.S. government has gotten some significant headline fines from Wall Street banks. J.P. Morgan, in particular, you have the mortgage settlement, which was many billions of dollars. But I say those are headline fines because the things that the banks could count toward those fines, they were able to count some mortgage principal reduction that they probably would have done anyway toward the settlements in those it sort of effectively counted as payments on those fines. I guess I share your cynicism about how much they would go after U.S. banks, but it is true that they've gotten at least as a headline number some fairly significant fines from some U.S. entities. Although I really have my doubts as to how much eventually gets paid and how much of those fines fall on the individuals who are really responsible for that behavior. But overall, you know, as I've been saying throughout this, you just have to say it's outrageous that we've seen, you know, one mid-level executive at Credit Suisse go to jail, and really, I guess, one limited civil fine on a very mid-level person at Goldman Sachs, the U.S. government have just not gone after individuals on Wall Street in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. What do you make of Eric Holder's, this was last year, a congressional hearing last year, comment? Does he have a point here or not? I am concerned, he said, that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them.
Yeah, he the too big to jail comment. He tried, I think, sort of frantically to walk that back after he made that comment. But it's true that this has been influencing the Department of Justice. I think it's pretty clear. I think that they heard that from financial regulators at certain points.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when they prosecuted Arthur Andersen and the company went out of business and people did lose jobs around that, they had questions. But, you know, I think there's a couple things to be said to that. First of all, that should not get in your way when it comes to prosecuting individuals or bringing cases against individuals. I mean, you can clearly go after individuals within an institution in all kinds of ways without destroying that institution, and frankly, it would probably make the institution healthier to do that. So that's not an excuse for not going after individuals. And in terms of going after entities, well, we were able to go after entities like Drexel Burnham, like Salomon Brothers, and take them down, and the markets went on just fine. I mean, it shouldn't be the case in a healthy market that you have an institution that can't go out of business. You know, that then there's fundamentally something wrong with the market, and that's the too big to fail problem in banking in general, which is a problem that we still haven't solved. I mean, multiple people at the Federal Reserve have said this problem isn't solved. The International Monetary Fund has recently said in a report again that there are still banks that are too big to fail. So, you know, we have to do that.
Did anything good happen from the 2010 Dodd-Frank reforms?
I think that, yeah, well, that's a big thing that Americans for Financial Reform does, is work on the implementation of Dodd-Frank. I think one really good thing that happened was the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and the CFPB has already gotten back hundreds of millions of dollars in it may even be billions at this point in direct reimbursements to consumers for wrongdoing. And I think that when you look at the part of the financial system that's the direct interface to consumers on loan products, so mortgages, credit cards, student loans, I think the CFPB is starting to be a really effective cop on the beat in that area. And that was a really important thing that Dodd-Frank did. I think for the sort of high finance areas, the creation of these toxic assets and the regulation of banks and investment banks and securities markets, we have a long way to go. There are elements of Dodd-Frank that could be really good if they were completed and enforced. One of them, for example, controls on executive pay to make sure that you can get back people's pay if they do something that later blows up and turns out to be, you know, they get a bonus in advance, but it later turns out to be a very risky activity. There's strong language on that in Dodd-Frank, but this administration has not completed a rule to implement that law. And frankly, the rules that they've been talking about for that are much too mild. So that's only one example of a good idea that hasn't been implemented.
Mm-hmm. Marcus, thank you. We have to say goodbye. No, don't be sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us. It was most informative. Marcus Stanley.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, Marcus Stanley, Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Earlier, Ben Protas, who's a writer for the New York Times and had a piece looking at probable criminal prosecution of two banks, foreign banks. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production as well. News is coming up. We'll return and talk about women and comedy.